accession number 3998, Real One.
Major Pasek, Real One.
Do you come from a military background?
Yes, my father was in the First World War and in the ASC, and his twin brother was killed at San Quentin. He was awarded a posthumous DCM, and also his younger brother was in the First World War, and that was that. So that my father was quite keen on me entering the service, which I did as a boy apprentice tradesman.
What sort of background do you come from?
Well, my father's family were Norfolk farmers. And then he moved to Manchester area, and met my mother, and I was born near Manchester. And had the usual schooling, and always seemed to have a desire to go.
Where were you educated?
Well, I went to the usual elementary school and then grammar school, but because of financial affairs, my father wasn't able to keep me, and I had to pack in at the grammar school, and I'd always wanted to go in the services. I wanted to go into the RAF, but the examination, the entrance exam, I'd been going to night school for this RAF exam, and unfortunately, at the time of the exam, which was held in Birmingham, my mother took very ill, and my father didn't want me to go away. And so I missed that opportunity, as I was over the age limit for the next exam, where I think they were once every year, I forget now, to be an apprentice tradesman. Well, so then I took the entrance exam as an army apprentice tradesman, as a fitter, which I passed the exam and went as an apprentice fitter. And I went to the RASC, they used to call it the Artificers Training College, no, Technical, Artificers Technical College in Aldershot. And I did a couple of years there. And then they were opening this new, or they had started this new boys' technical school at Chepstow, and we were transferred from Aldershot to Chepstow, starting off, or helping to start, this new technical school at Chepstow. And I was one of the first boys there. I think I was in, I think it was 7 group. And from then on, your army as a boy, your apprenticeship lasted usually about 3 years. Then you went off to your own unit, regiment or corps, in my case the RASC, back to Aldershot, where you complete your regimental training. Then I went on to heavy repair shops at Feltham, still continuing your apprenticeship in the army. Your apprenticeship didn't really finish till you passed out as a first class tradesman. And from Feltham, I went to what was called the mobile repair unit at Woolwich, where eventually I passed my first class trade test as a fitter, and then volunteered for overseas service. I wanted to go to Shanghai, but there was only one RASC company in Shanghai with a small workshop detachment, and there was consequently very few vacancies, and I didn't go. But I went to Egypt, Abyssinia, There were big workshops there. And from Abusir, I heard about possibilities of vacancies in the Sudan Defence Force. A friend of mine had gone down there and written to me and told me it was a great life. And so I thought I would like to try this. So a vacancy occurred and I applied for it and was sent down to Khartoum and still with the RESC. And after a couple of months in Khartoum, I was seconded, after several interviews, I was seconded to the Sudan Defence Force and went to the Mechanical Transport Department. And
what sort of questions did they ask you at your interviews? Can you remember?
Oh, good Lord, no.
What sort of qualities were they looking for?
I remember you had to be first class in everything, in other words, education and trade, and you had to have knowledge of a couple of other trades, which I had, and
what other
trades? Questions, well, the other trade, electrician and turner, and that's a vehicle electrician, of course, and before I passed out at Woolwich, I had gone continuing my education, going to night school and Woolwich Polytechnic and so forth on in my own time. And eventually, when I was in Cairo, I was interviewed for the Sudan job, Sudan Defence Force job, and then I went down there, still with the RESC, to the RESC detachment in Khartoum, and I had more interviews, and I think they were looking for, I should think, technical ability, and I think I had that, because at Chepstow even, I was one of the top boys in my group, passing out, and received a prize, and I'd attained my class one fitters, passed the class one fitters test a little bit earlier than some people did, and I think they were looking for technical ability and possibly character. I didn't drink, and I had one that I think stood in good stead, because to somebody who drank out there, it wasn't a very good life at all, because the two didn't seem to go, alcohol and the heat. And what else now?
Was it difficult to get into the Sudan Defence Force?
Oh yes. It was a plum. It was one of the plum jobs of the British Army. And there were a few of these secondment jobs. There was the West African Frontier Force, the Somaliland Camel Corps, and West African Somaliland, and the King's African Rifles, and the Indian Army. Well, the Indian Army was easy to get into, but the others weren't. And
why did you apply for Sudan?
Pardon?
Why did you apply for the Sudan?
Because I had a friend of mine who'd gone down there, and I remember as a boy reading about Gordon and the life of Gordon and Khartoum and all that sort of thing, and the fall of Khartoum and the relief of Khartoum by Kitchener, and I'd got interested in it, I suppose, in the back of my mind, and I'd always stayed interested in it, and I somehow or other, even in Cairo, I didn't seem to mind when we went out into the local desert around Cairo. I didn't mind the sand. I used to like it, and I liked the life, and I thought I would like the Sudan, and from what I'd heard and been told, it was a good job, and So I applied with, there were a few others, but I was the only one accepted, and I was selected, and that was that. And I had three interviews. I was interviewed first by the officer who was the commander of the mechanical transport department. He interviewed me on technical ability. Then I was interviewed by an officer in Sudan Defence Force headquarters. I think he was the AAG, I'm not sure. And he was a senior officer. And he just asked me questions, more or less, I suppose, of probing one's character. They were general questions and general knowledge and so forth, and background. And military career, what had done and so on, and leadership, I suppose. And then the third interview was with an officer from the Camel Corps, where I was ultimately destined for. And he seemed to like me very much, his job, and funnily enough, I served under him later on in the war years. But and that was that. So then I went into the Sudan Defence Force, and
where was your first posting?
My first posting was to the Mechanical Transport Department. I think it would be in, I think it was about 1934.
And where was the Mechanical Transport Department?
The Mechanical Transport Department was in big workshops in Khartoum North, that is over the Blue Nile from Khartoum itself. And we had a British Warrant Officers and NCOs mess in the Sudan Defence Force, which was about a couple of miles, I suppose, from the workshop. So you used to have to traverse the bridge over the Blue Nile to get to the Khartoum North. And to do this, we all had to buy bicycles. We had no personal transport as such, and so it was a question of biking every day across the river, which was very interesting sometimes, and quite pleasant. You'd go in the early morning and cycle back at 8 o'clock for breakfast, and cycle back again at 9 o'clock to start the main part of the day, and then you'd finish about 1 or half past and cycle back, and that was your day's work, finished. And it was quite a comfortable life, and I was learning Arabic, technical side of the Arabic vocabulary as well, whilst in the workshops. And there were some of the native troops who were going to be in my workshops ultimately, and I had to help to train as well. And it was a vehicle workshops, very big workshops, comprehensive, fully comprehensive, with a very large stores, which again I learnt the finer elements of storekeeping, because although I had knowledge of storekeeping, storekeeping was one of the things you had to be able to do when you're out on your own with a multi-machine gun company where I was due to go to. And after a few months there, I eventually went to El Obeid, which is the province headquarters of Kordofan province and the headquarters of the Sudan Defence Force Camel Corps.
And what was the setup at El Obeid?
And the setup at El Obeid was the Camel Corps headquarters, comprising of the commanding officer, who was a Mirali, and second in command was a Kaimakam. And then there was a senior native officer who was also a Kaimakam, who later became the first either Prime Minister or President, I forget which it was, of the independent Sudan, named Abdullah Khalil Bey. Very nice gentleman, very nice chap, who I got very friendly with. And then there was the mechanical transport base workshops, El Obeid being the railhead. There's a big workshops there. And one machine gun company, of which I was the BNCO. And there are two British officers with the machine gun company. This was number two motor machine gun company. At that time, there were three motor machine gun companies in the Sudan Defence Force. Number one company was the original one with engineered troops in Omdurman. And number two company, the one I was with at El Obeid, the Camel Corps, the second one. And number three company was formed more or less at the same time, I think about a year before I got there. That was, number three company was with the Western Arab Corps in El Fasher in Darfur province. They were just, in that, at that time, they were just the three companies. And there was going to be a new company formed, which I was ultimately going to be the BNCO with, and that was number four company at an outpost about 40 miles from Barra. This 40 miles seems quite local, but it was in fact a day's trek by camel, or at least 4 hours by vehicle, because it was very deserty conditions, scrub country with a lot of acacia and no proper road as such, just desert. And consequently, even in with vehicles, it was quite a job to get to the place. And I had some camel troops with me in number two company, who were learning from number four company at Barra, who I was teaching to become technicians or and drivers as well. And and our duties in with the Camel Corps machine gun company were purely at that time internal defence, because it was before the Italo-Abyssinian War, and we really, all what we had to do was really training and sometimes going out showing the flag. If there'd been any tribal trouble, we'd go and let ourselves be felt and quieten up any tribal trouble. Which sometimes did occur, particularly in the Nuba Mountains, with the Nuba different tribes, or in the central and northern part of the province with the various Arab tribes, usually with cultivation boundary squabbles. And I remember later, when I went to number four company, once we were called to a tribal squabble, and it was quite fantastic. We went out with a few machine gun cars, and this was quite local to Barra, and we saw that we were on a slight hillock, and looking down, we could see the two groups of Arabs confronting each other, about 80 chaps on either side. Behind them, a row of screaming women and wives, all screaming out, and these chaps were shouting across at each other. What was in the centre was presumably the imaginary boundary line. And what had happened was that somebody's cattle had moved over into the other tribe's grazing land. Usually they were mainly camels. When I said cattle, mainly camels and a few cows and sheep and goats and sheep, and the boundaries of these cultivated or sometimes just grazing areas were purely fictitious, because there was no way of telling one from the how they knew them. We could really never find out, except you'd say, well, that acacia tree over there is in my land, you see, and that one there is in his land. And anyway, these two, the district commissioner was with us, and he'd gone down to try and stop the squabble, and he didn't seem to be having any luck, so he came back, and the Bimbashi, and he had a few words, so all that, what they did, they just decided to let one of the machine guns fire a few rounds into the air and away from them, just to scare them off. And this is what happened, and within no time at all, as soon as they heard a few bangs going off, the quartened down, and the two sheikhs of either side went together with the district commissioner, and everything was Bob's your uncle, all right. And that was that. But then,
was life very different for you out at Mel Abeid?
Oh yes, yes. It was an entirely different. You went into a different world because you straight away you left the British Army life when you went to the Sudan Defence Force. In Khartoum, you lived in a mess. It was a mess life, silence mess life. Normal, I would say, normal mess life. The discipline was less rigid. But when you got to your, away from Khartoum, to your Camel Corps posting, your machine gun company, then you were with two British officers, just the two of you, and there were, in other words, three white officers. And or two white officers and one white NCO, and three native NCOs, three native officers, and the life itself was quite different. You left your rank; you weren't called sergeant. You were addressed as Mr. And the reason being that, and you didn't wear your rank either in peacetime, and except on ceremonial parades. And
why was this?
Pardon?
Why didn't you wear
your rank? Reason for this, I think, was the native set up a rank was such that it would have meant that had you been addressed as sergeant, the Arabic word for sergeant is shawish, and a shawish in with the native troops is just an ordinary rank. And also they have a sergeant major who is called a bashawish, and they have a warrant officer who is an educated type, the chief clerk of the company, and he is called the Sol, S-O-L. And it would have meant that a white NCO would have been junior in rank to two of the native troops. So consequently, if you were being referred to, you were always Mr. by either the native officers or the British officers. If the British officer addressed you, it's usually by your surname, and never sergeant. If the native officers referred to you, or the natives referred to you, the native troops, you were referred to as the Bash Mahandas, or again, Mr. The Bash Mahandas, meaning chief engineer, which is what you were out there as. You were the chief engineer, the chief fitter, Bash Mahandas was the Arabic title that we were referred to by the native troops. And the transport, there were four vehicles for officers. The difference between the officers' vehicles and the machine gun vehicles were that the officers' vehicles had canopies, and the company commander's vehicle actually had a windscreen, which at first, in the later days, that was done away with because it was found that the glare, the sun on the windscreen giving a glare, could give away the position of the unit if we were trying to hide from an enemy or so on. And at first they had windscreens, but later they took the windscreens down. And there were the four officers' vehicles, and the the commanding officer's vehicle was O number one, and the second officer's vehicle, the second in command's vehicle, was O number two, The senior native officer, Captain Yuzbashi, his Arabic rank, he had vehicle number 3, and the fourth vehicle with the canopy, that was the BNCO's, his number was 04. And then after that, the other vehicles were numbered consecutively from 1 downwards without a prefix letter. And each officer also had a 30 hundredweight truck to carry his personal belongings when it was trekking, his tent and baggage and so forth, and the baggage of his own staff, which comprised of a cook and a houseboy, which you were allowed to take on trek with you. And of course you had your own driver who acted as batman when you were on trek. In the peace station, it was always referred to the peace station, was your base station. Your own driver didn't have so much work to do as a batman, because you had your own houseboy, and the batman rarely came into it. But when you were out on trek, then the batman did have a little bit more to do.
What were your domestic arrangements at El Obeid?
At El Obeid, I had a bungalow. First I lived in the rest house, then I had a bungalow, and I had a houseboy, known as a safragi, and a cook. And the accommodation was a bachelor's accommodation, and this was pretty general throughout the Sudan. The bungalow for a junior official was comprised of one living room, come dining room, and a bedroom and a bathroom, and a veranda either side, and then an extension from the veranda out in the so-called garden, which wasn't a garden because it was all sand, was a piece of concrete slab or tile slab known as a mastaba, where you sat out on the evening. The reason for this was that you couldn't sit on the sand, in the sand, because your feet would get into the sand and you'd probably get lots of snakes and insects and reptiles and whatnot, especially when you're out in the outstations. And this was the sort of setup throughout the Sudan as far as accommodation, the only difference being that as you became upgraded in seniority or married, so you got a bigger house or a bungalow, that was all. But of course...